Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday, the 17th of November. It is 14 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we welcome you to a new week, a new set of programs, and we are thrilled that you are here and with us, and we hope you had a beautiful weekend and that you enjoyed your time doing whatever it is that you were doing, and we are just very happy that we are back together to talk about what's going on in the news. Let's get to that in just a moment. Last night, I was going through and picking out the stories as I was watching the football game, and then I don't know, maybe about 10:30, 11 o'clock, I said, okay, that's it, and I went to bed, and then I heard I could have just heard my phone just go neat, neat. And those were all the breaking news alerts that were coming out. I was like, we'll update when we get up. We'll figure this out. It'll all be there in the morning. That's what my wife said. It'll all be there in the morning. Well, so we have some stuff that broke overnight. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the stuff that happened over the weekend. And we'll be in good shape. Let me introduce the group to you. We're very happy to have this group together. And we welcome UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies who... it's been a little while, and I'm thrilled to have you back. Jennifer Burns, how are you?
I'm wonderful. I'm coming off of a JB domestic tour. That's where I've been.
Yes, okay.
I'm very busy.
Well, it's wonderful that you can have the time to be with us this morning. We appreciate it. We always love when you're here, and thank you very much.
Thank you. It's always lovely to be here.
We also welcome Senior Fellow of Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, who often joins us on a Monday morning. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. I just want to say that yesterday my band, the Art Stanton Quartet, played in Rensselaerville, and so way in the western part of Albany County. It's a hike for me from Albany, but it went very well. Shout out to Patrick, the library director there, and to a fellow roundtable panelist, Robert Pondicio, who arranged the whole thing. So he's on the library board and made it happen, and it went very well.
You know, you give those panelists like 5 minutes in the green room alone, and the stuff they whip is just amazing. All kinds of things that are happening. Thrilled to offer welcome a newbie to our program, and really, really happy he's with us. Bard College Vice Chancellor of Global Higher Education Alliance for the 21st Century, Executive Vice President and Vice President for Academic Affairs and Director of the Center for Civic Engagement. Jonathan Becker is with us. Good morning, Jonathan. How are you?
I'm really thrilled to be here. I will point out that Bard likes to give a lot of titles because it doesn't like to pay people. That's why I have so many.
But, is that the reason?
Exactly. But I am super happy. I was telling Jim before the show that the last time I was supposed to be in the studios of WAMC was January 7th, 2000. And I know that because my son was born that day, so I had to call and cancel because he was one of the 4% who were actually born on their due day. So that I finally made it back into the studio is thrilling for me, and I'm really happy to be here today.
So now the kids, like, graduated college.
Right? Absolutely. A quarter century has gone by, and here we are. And I'm still talking about voting.
Well, Jonathan is the author of an amazing new book called Youth Voting Rights, Civil Rights, the 26th Amendment, and the Fight for American Democracy on College Campuses. And we will talk to him in depth about the book around 10:35, 10:40 this morning, but he's going to join us for the panel as well. And we'll be talking about voting rights through the course of the panel. So all of that, very nice to have you with us, and I thank you very much for making it back after all these years. All right, let's go to one of the little chirps on my phone last night was the fact that the president reversed his stance on the Epstein files ahead of the House vote, and you may say what, and I would say well. The tide was starting to turn, and the president late Sunday urged House Republicans to back a measure that would compel the Justice Department to release files related to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, reversing his stance after facing the prospect that The measure could receive dozens of Republican votes. "We have nothing to hide," Mr. Trump said after weeks of campaigning against the bill. Whether a Schiff would speed the release of the files was unclear. It is clear that this is just for asking Republicans to vote, to have a vote on it. It does not then say what the Justice Department will do or when or how and all of that. And then, of course, it does have to go through the Senate as well. Whether a Schiff would speed the release, unclear. If the bill passed the House and a vote expected this week, it still has to face very tough odds in the Senate. So that is one of the stories. This is after weeks of campaigning against a bill. And the president, I think, probably was aware of what was being said on the morning news shows on Sunday, where many Republicans were saying this has to go for a vote. Then at one point, Mo Khanna, I believe, saying we probably have 100 votes. And then even as the day went on, the House Speaker Mike Johnson saying, "Yeah, I think this is gonna move forward." So, with that, the president then turned and said, "Okay, well, let it go then." Jim Henler.
Ketterer.
Jim Ketterer. I do that occasionally.
You know, Jim is just one of those names.
And I feel horrible when I do it. I just really, really do. My sincere apologies. And I mean, not that there's anything being wrong with being called Jim Henler, but it's not your name, so why would I do that? Jim Ketterer, how are you?
I'm well. And on this issue, you know, I really, as you were saying, Joe, I think that the president realized the tide is turning against him, and politically it wasn't going to make sense to push back on it anymore. I'm still, though, convinced that behind the scenes he's hoping that the Senate is not going to pass it so he can, you know, ride high and say, okay, I supported the release of this, but still the Senate wouldn't pass it, and then he can blame whoever he wants to blame in the Senate. I think it's important to remember that a few days ago he suggested that, in fact, I think he directed the Department of Justice to start investigating several Democrats in the Epstein case. And I do wonder if now that those investigations are underway, I think the Manhattan federal attorney is leading that charge, that any information in those files that's related to those investigations probably cannot be released. And so I'm also betting that the bill happened to be passed in both houses and it goes to his desk for signature and he signs it, that there would be some hemming and hawing about what can really be released, and there would be a fair amount of information that would not be released. So I call me skeptical, highly skeptical on this, but I...
I can't even call you Jim Henler.
Yeah, exactly. Call me Henler on this. I think this is a tactical move without any real substance behind it.
You know, what's interesting about this, too, is that it seems like the whole plan backfired. Because just after the shutdown, the Democrats then say, okay, we have these emails. They went out, and fairly damning, because they're including after years of the president saying that he didn't know the guy and he had never met him and so forth, that there were indications that they were much closer than the president had let on. Then, to make that better, Republicans put out, 20,000 emails, and I don't know if they pre-read them or not, but they didn't help the matter as far as getting the president's name out of the story. And so that brought us to the point that we're at now, and then you have all of these other aspects to the story, like Marjorie Taylor Greene and the back and forth and the inner fighting and squabbles that are taking place there. Jonathan Becker.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, let's be clear. What happened to the victims of Epstein, the survivors, is absolutely tragic. there's the tragedy is of the people who suffered, and there are people who either contributed, Prince Andrew, or who remained silent. And I think that's the area where people are suggesting Trump might have been involved. The problem is none of this is sticking to Trump, right? And I think the real issue is that because of the Epstein scandal, he can't control the agenda. And to the extent that he's involved in the agenda, he's controlling it poorly. So he also said, you know, with some, there's no irony in this, that we should be talking about affordability, right? Not about what's going on in the Epstein situation. I think two other things are important. And Jim pointed to one of them, you know, which is that the Justice Department is now investigating Democrats. That abuse of the Justice Department is itself really important. But the other thing, which I just don't think gets enough play, is the treatment of Maxwell is so outrageous. Here you have a person who a judge said in sentencing was untruthful, said was part of a horrific scheme involved in sexual abuse of young women. And she is being treated, you know, to like a country club status within a federal facility. That is truly unbelievable. And the focusing on that part of things and the shamelessness that goes on with that is truly amazing. And just the last thing I would say is we're hearing about all of these Republicans who are going to vote for the release of the documents. But at the end of the day, it was only four Republicans who actually tipped this. If it wasn't for Massey, an unlikely group of Massey, Boebert, Green, and Nancy Mace, we would not be having this conversation right now and they would be stuck. I actually think at the end of the day, you know, for Trump, these getting out will be better because nothing sticks to him. Even when that image that he signed with his name signed in the letter for Epstein's birthday came out, and the New York Times pointed out, obviously, like, it looks a lot like his signature, right? It didn't matter. So I think that, in fact, at the end of the day, he would be better getting this information out no matter what's there because nothing sticks to him. But the scandal of Maxwell is huge, and I think that that deserves more attention.
Jennifer.
Yeah, I agree on the scandal with Maxwell. That is, it's appalling in every way possible. And it also shows the level of sort of corruption, in some sense, in the criminal justice system itself, right? That certain people, depending on who they're connected to, can get different benefits, which is the opposite of what Trump ran on, right? He's going to clean up all this corruption everywhere. So there's that, you know. And I agree. I think a lot of this is performative. I think it is to make Trump appear like he did the right thing when it comes to this case. And I'm not saying he's guilty of all kinds of things. I mean, this is these are events that took place for almost two decades. Right? When he and others associated amongst their peer group of wealthy people, right? So it is not surprising to me that we will see all kinds of names in these documents if they are released and not redacted, right? We've had a lot of time and a lot of delay in what was going to be released. So how and what that contains is going to be an interesting part of this story, too, I think, after the fact. And I also think that this is another example of how society dismisses and doesn't listen to women, especially women who, you know, say that they have been victimized and they have been groomed. And this should be a no-brainer. Really, right? It has been proven in the court of law over and over again. And it's not just about accessing the documents. It's about really saying that women's lives matter, and especially when they're kids and you have this large network of grooming and trafficking, that essentially what we're saying now is that doesn't matter. So I think that's another part of the story that needs to be talked about a lot more. I mean, I know it's on the news, but we really still normalize the downplay of it.
Well, you look at the victims and those who have spoken out and how they are scrutinized, mm-hmm. and have to tell the story over and over and over, mm-hmm. and over again.
Yeah.
to the point where one of them commits suicide over and the death threats that they receive and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that that happens and those who are responsible or allegedly responsible do not receive anywhere near the scrutiny is something that seems very sad in this case.
100%.
As all of these cases
right,
are.
Right,
yes.
But 100%. And I think, you know, it's interesting, too, that you see now the way, although people aren't really talking about this so much, I mean, it's in the news a little bit, that the angry mobs are turning on Marjorie Taylor Greene, right, and Lauren Boebert, and these other people who are asking that women, and these women in particular, are being defended, right? So this is another example, too, of how this administration in particular, you are good as long as you're going along with them, but the moment you're not, there's more fear and intimidation even within their own party that is used to silence you.
We'll discuss this more. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. We'll add letters in as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Jonathan Becker, Jennifer Burns, and Jim Ketterer. Yes, Ketterer is with us. Jim Henler did check in and say I scared him. He was getting ready for the day and heard his name and thought he was supposed to be here. It's very nice to have you all with us. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Susan writes, does anyone think that files in the possession of this Justice Department have not been altered to protect some individuals? I don't know if they'd be altered, but they just may not be fully released, right?
Yeah, that's my sense, that they wouldn't be fully released. I also wanted to just say, following up on what my colleagues were talking about, before the break, the idea that nothing sticks to Trump, which does seem to be true, and Trump himself predicted that when he said he could shoot somebody in Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't change anything. But we do see lots of other rumblings, some shifts with the base, and so, you know, whether it's Boebert, Marjorie Taylor Greene, whatever, they're not immune to things sticking to them, and they're responding to all kinds of pushback one way or the other. I was also reading stories about all kinds of infighting happening in the West Wing, not the East Wing, because that doesn't exist anymore, but the West Wing.
Construction zone.
Yeah, and that the chief of staff is taking a lot of flack, Susie Wiles, and that is often, I think, also a proxy for flack that people want to direct at the president, but they really can't for a variety of reasons. So they start directing it at other people close to the president. And so I think we're going to see more and more of this infighting. You know, it's not, shockingly enough, I don't think it's a well-run White House. I don't think it's a well-run team, a well-selected team. And they're turning on each other. So I think we'll see more and more of that kind of manifestation of dysfunction.
Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, I would simply say that Trump's mishandling of the affordability issue, which is what, you know, came out in the elections that happened last week or the week before, and the failure of Republicans, the success of Democrats, and a number of demographics, is the more important issue ultimately. And his denial that prices are going up proved to be a huge problem nationally because it's so obviously not true, right? And not true in a I've seen an image of Trump that he signed, but not true in a way that people see on a day-to-day basis. And I think that in some ways, Green has done him a favor by saying, you should be addressing this issue. And I think even his announcement, even full of spleen directed at Green, includes the notion that affordability matters. And I think he's going to focus that. I think he'll blame Biden for everything, but I think he'll focus on that. So we'll see. I think just the last thing is that, you know, Trump, one of the reasons why they keep on dangling the idea of a third term is because he's going to become a lame duck at some point. And when that happens, there will really be Knives Out. And the longer you can make it seem like you will be there perpetually, the easier it is to rule, and the easier it is to put down the divisiveness and the intra-party divisions that Jim was talking about. So
it's interesting you mentioned that, because there were at least three editorials over the weekend that said he's becoming a lame duck before our eyes right now, with what has been happening over the last several weeks.
Yeah, you know, I remember with Bush, the second, it was like Hurricane Katrina is when the bubble burst. And I thought that his insistence that there's no affordability issue might have been that. And I think that, you know, this is something where it will be interesting to see how the pivot goes and how he focuses on that and where the Epstein fits into that. I think they want to turn the page on that and focus on other things.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Tom Macy was talking about this too, right, that people are going to outlast Trump. And that's a concern for them. They need to make sure that they're holding on to the power that they have, which is what they want to do. So there's a, how do you make yourself look really good and that you're fighting for your people, your constituents here, and distancing yourself enough to still benefit from the shadow of Trump when this blows over, because it's going to blow over. I mean, people can keep talking about it, right? And we're going to keep debating about it. And we're going to get these maybe a massive load of emails and more files. But I still have the question is, what's going to come of it?
I'm also fascinated by where you have the Trump administration spending so much time at the end of last week while all of this was happening, and now, oh, we're going to go after Obama. We're going to, the investigation against Obama and Obama officials, and we have this attorney who's going to be the prosecutor, and I don't know. Do those distractions work in moving the conversation away from the things that seem to matter to most people directly, and ultimately what becomes of them?
I think those distractions are less effective now, particularly in the face of, Jonathan is saying, with the affordability issue, because people see the prices every day. They see that what has been peddled by the administration on tariffs and other policies simply isn't turning into more affordability. And even people like Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene came out and said that the Mamdani campaign was right on the mark. That's the kind of campaign that needs to be run. And, you know, I don't think they were saying that somebody should vote for them, but just in terms of campaign tactics, they were full of all kinds of praise. And I think that kind of praise is also, an indirect attack on the president's inability to understand how important this issue is.
The president is saying that he expects to meet with Mamdani. We'll see. And said, quote, we'll work something out between Mamdani and Trump. Stay tuned.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I think what's interesting is, you know, the constant go back, this playbook in Trump's part, right, that you bring up Obama, because it's such a dog whistle for all the other things, too. It's like Obamacare is terrible. Obama's terrible, right? Voting rights now are before the Supreme Court again, which the Shelby versus Kramer happened during Obama's presidency, right? That Supreme Court decision. So, you know, it's dog whistle politics. It inspires some unconscious bias and some flat out racism in uniting his base again without him actually saying it. He just stirs the pot with that kind of deflection.
You see the pictures along the long hallway in the White House, mm-hmm. and then there's the auto pen for Biden, mm-hmm. and then for Obama, he points out to Laura Ingraham. He was the worst president. In top five,
mm-hmm.
top five of the worst presidents. And then, of course, you want to ask, like, all right, so who are the other four?
Uh-huh.
Besides you, Mr. President.
Besides you, Mr. President, right. Exactly. All right, let's go and go to a few more letters this morning and check in with Call Me Crazy, says Dave. But I think Trump has been pardoning everybody in sight because he was planning to throw Maxwell into the mix. Trump would have hoped nobody noticed or that he could lie about not knowing it was done or just try to con people into believing that he's such a forgiving guy. She was going to lie again, saying whatever it is Trump wanted her to. Then she would have released and immediately leave the country to be out of our jurisdiction. The increased attention on Epstein and the release of files that contradict her interview testimony has likely ruined that plan.
Can I just mention, yes, at the beginning of that letter, the listener is talking about how Trump is pardoning everybody. And this is another one of those, you know, massive abuses that, as Jennifer was talking about, just deep corruption in the system. The number of people that Trump has pardoned in 10 and a half months is so far beyond what other presidents have done in 8 years. He has also, you know, lifted the required legal restitution over a billion, with a B, $1 billion of restitution that had been owed by people who were convicted of crimes. He's lifted that. And this, what seems to be a pay-to-play system, is just an absolute outrage. And it's so much. Every day, they're pardoning multiple people. And the former pardon attorney who was fired, Liz Oyer, she's doing a great job in revealing this and keeping the focus on it. But the relentlessness of it, I think, just exhausts people, and they're not paying attention anymore.
Right.
Well, and this is the pattern, too. Look at who he pardoned in his first term, right?
He's even outstripping that now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's no guardrails now.
Mm-hmm.
Diane writes, let's all remember that once prices go up, it's all but impossible for retail to put those prices back. If the American consumer thinks this will happen by Thanksgiving, good luck with that.
$2 instead of 30.
Yes,
remember that?
That's right. $2 instead. That's mm-hmm. absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Well, you got to dust some of these off sometimes and try them again. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, actually, one more question from Brian. Will we see cabinet members walk if damning evidence comes out? I think this gets to your point of the infighting.
Yeah, I don't know. It's quite a collection of cabinet members. Hard to predict what might happen with them.
No.
No, I don't think so either.
Well, I do remember, and I can't come up with the names right now, but at the end of the first administration, when between the beginning of January and between January 6th and the inauguration, that people just were jumping off the ship. And those people very proudly years later say, well, I left the administration on principle. Well, you were there. I mean, it was... He was leaving. They were packing the boxes already.
I mean, I think after midterms, we'll see people mm-hmm. exit, in part because they're going to want to run for his position.
Right.
But before then, I think you'll be seen as being anti-Trump, and you're not going to get elected that way, I'm afraid.
We'll take a break. We'll come back, work on news stories as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday. And we welcome you, as always, to talk about or share what's on your mind about these stories. So please join us. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. All right, so let's talk about Border Patrol shifts to the south. Border Patrol is fanning out across Charlotte, North Carolina, arresting 81 people in the first day. Border Patrol agents descended on Charlotte this weekend, searching for immigrants in the country illegally. It remains unclear how long the agents will stay. A flea market that is typically filled with Hispanic vendors was canceled this weekend. Nightclubs that play reggae music on Saturday nights decided not to open. And Catholic churches, which tend to have many immigrant parishioners, were unusually empty on Sunday morning. The Trump administration crackdown on illegal immigrants arrived in Charlotte this weekend, resulting in 81 arrests on Saturday. It continued on Sunday with Border Patrol agents fanning out across the largest city in the state. An immigration rights group said the tally reported by a senior Border Patrol official on social media was the largest number of immigrant arrests in the state's recent history. The presence of the agents, led by Gregory Bovino, who directed similar operations in Chicago and Los Angeles this year, has startled people in one of the fastest-growing cities in the country. Much of that growth has been spurred by international migration, especially from Latin America. The city is also home to large corporations in retail, banking, and manufacturing sectors. The increase in immigration has drawn the attention of Trump administration officials who have been targeting communities with large immigrant populations for enforcement efforts. That from the New York Times. Jennifer.
I knew you were going to start with me, and I was trying to look something up.
I can go. You look up, and I'll okay. go to Jonathan, and then we'll go over.
Yeah, I mean, I'll start in my hometown of Chicago, where last week they released some data because there was a lawsuit based on a consent decree of what the government could do with warrantless arrests of folk. And they had some fascinating data. Of the 608 detainees, only 16, or 2.6%, had criminal histories. So the claim that we're arresting the worst of the worst is simply not true. And many people are being grabbed in these dragnets. Bovino, who you mentioned, said afterwards that if this judge intervenes to release these people, they will arrest twice as many, right, using various means of collateral arrests and otherwise. I think the one thing I want to say, which I don't think gets enough play, though, is the immense individual harm this has, not just on undocumented people, but on asylees, right? We deal with a lot of them. I deal with a lot of them. I was very much involved with getting a few hundred people out of Afghanistan, many of who have come to the United States, and dealing with asylees from various places. And the corrosive nature that this system has on them. The immense difficulty, the mental health wear and tear, the concern for families. We have people from Afghanistan who are human rights activists who know if they go back what the consequences will be. You have people from Haiti, similarly, who are facing similar challenges. Venezuela, which hasn't come up today, which is really interesting. We're threatening to attack Venezuela, and yet we're sending people from Venezuela out of the country and removing their temporary protected status. These people are suffering and hurting, and on a very human level, I think we need to acknowledge the difficulties that this causes for them and the real anguish and anxiety that causes them and their families.
I guess I may have missed it, but Charlotte wouldn't have been on my bingo card initially. I mean, it makes sense, obviously, given the demographics that you see now. But given the other cities, given the demographic makeup, or Democratic makeup, I guess, right. It's similar too, that it would, that one sort of surprised me.
It's a purple state. Go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jim. So, yes, this is another one of those, you know, race baiting, but also has real effects on people's lives, right? And Charlotte has become a more diverse city. But also, you know, I think the other thing to look at here is how Noam and others see the shift. Not in the Latino population, right? New polls have come out about how they have moved away from the Republican Party in particular, and especially you could see that in the last election, right? And so this is a crackdown, whereas before it was on just the Democratic cities. Now it's more on those cities, too, where you see a Latino population that may be shifting away from, or as at least the polls indicate, from supporting Trump or the Republicans. So I think there's more than just creating fear and putting out these videos to try to get your base to see that you're doing this America first, get rid of those foreigners situation. I think it's also to target people coming out to vote, right? It's an additional, you send terror. And I know that sounds like you'd shoot yourself in the foot, but that's often how this administration operates. The other thing, and this has already come up, but I think it's really worth paying attention to, is how many of these people are actually have a criminal record or are undocumented. Because that doesn't appear to me to actually be, like, it's such a spectacle that I don't really see how any of this is meant to really, I don't want to say catch, but get people who are undocumented or are criminals. It's really not about that, because I think there's other ways that could happen.
Yeah, I think the other ways that it could happen, it falls under the heading of due process,
mm-hmm.
and our normal systems by which these things can be implemented in a reasonable way that doesn't create a spectacle, as
mm-hmm.
you said. That's a good word for it. And it's a spectacle that I think is designed for a variety of audiences and a variety of reasons to create fear.
Mm-hmm.
And to normalize these kinds of behaviors across the country in a variety of different places. Joe, you said, oh, you wouldn't have guessed Charlotte. I think the idea that this is always one step ahead of where one might guess
right.
it's going to happen
yeah.
next is all part of it.
Well, right. I mean, before, when we were looking, moving into Washington and Chicago, there were these grand pronouncements, we're coming.
Right.
Whereas,
we're going to fix
that.
The crime problem
right,
or something.
Yes.
And now there's not even the pretense of fixing the crime problem.
Right.
It is specific to the populations that Jonathan and Jennifer were talking about. I do think that the midterm elections are in the background of this.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of it. I also just think, you know, I continue to be surprised the extent to which people that I interact with on a daily basis are not fully grasping the gravity of the situation. And there's a lot of sense that, like, well, boy, if things were to continue this way, you know, we really might be going down kind of an authoritarian path. And guess what? We're down it. There's not going to be some pronouncement all of a sudden like, oh, we now live in an authoritarian regime. But when you see masked men engaged in this behavior at multiple cities around our country, when you see the failure of due process and on and on and on, it's not what might happen. It's what is happening now. And the failure of imagination, the failure of grasping the gravity of these circumstances, I think is also very dangerous, but it's part of the plan.
Mm-hmm. There's something else interesting going on, which is, to me, in some ways even more frightening, which is that Trump is also being attacked from the further right. So last week, when he talked about H-1B visas and that Americans can't do certain jobs or can't do jobs, you know, he was pilloried for it within the party. He did something really interesting, higher education, right, which... it's a $50 billion a year industry for international students coming to the United States. And somehow he suddenly woke up to the fact that he was destroying this mm-hmm. and said we should have Chinese students because they'll help pay and support universities, which I don't think is a bad thing, and was pilloried for that, right? There was an interesting piece, I think it's Ron Dreher, who now lives in Hungary, the land of Viktor Orban, who many people in the Trump regime want to model themselves on. And he comes back and he says, look, if you look at young folk in the Republican Party, 30 to 40% are followers of Nick Fuentes. So the real danger mm-hmm. is beyond this, which is what people want to, you know, Trump is... pragmatic in many ways, as long as it means that he can be the head of things, right? And in this circumstance, him being outflanked to the right is a really frightening circumstance.
So according to what I read on Truth Social this week, Nick Fuentes good, Seth Meyers bad.
Mm-hmm. And Tucker Carlson good for having Nick Fuentes,
on.
Yes. I mean, that is truly
Scorecard
frightening. Scorecard
is really hard to keep up. Mm-hmm. I mean, not really, but still. All right. Mm-hmm. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue more topics. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Jonathan Becker, Jennifer Burns, and Jim Ketterer with us this morning. We welcome you, and we will continue. First, though, we have a few messages, and we go over to a news break with our David Gustina. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 17th of November. Very nice to have you with us. We have a great group. Let me just remind you who is on our panel this morning. Bard College Vice Chancellor of Global Higher Education Alliance and Executive Vice President and Vice President for Academic Affairs and Director of the Center for Civic Engagement. Jonathan Becker joins us, also the author of Youth Voting Rights, a new book that he actually wrote chapters in and co-edited, and we will talk to him about that in detail in just about a half hour or so. We also welcome Jennifer Burns, UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies and senior fellow of Bard College for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. I want to move on to other topics. We do have a couple of leftover letters from before we went to break. Bob says, what about the suspension of a professor at Indiana University?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this professor was teaching, it sounds, and from what I could find to read, about white supremacy, the history of white supremacy in particular. And it appears that a student wrote to a senator, I think, saying that the lecture itself made them uncomfortable. And so that professor has been let go. And I think this is one of the individual examples, but there are many, of a collective movement to, in some sense, whitewash American history, but also to prevent us from talking about the historical facts of different time periods. We are seeing, and this is from a historian's perspective, we're seeing a lot of the language that was used in the laws of Reconstruction and in Jim Crow legislation. That language is being kind of resurfaced and reused again today. And I think some people are one, unaware of when that language originated from and how it was used back then, and that it's being reintroduced now. And I think it's shocking, and I think I don't want to say that all students or this student in particular that may have said it made them uncomfortable, if this is true, see it as a reverse racism, as people say, quote unquote, or things like that. I think it's just having not talked about these things or not learned about them in the past means that for some people it's so shocking that they don't want to believe that it's true today. There's a bit of a cognizant dissonance happening.
I think in the Indiana case also, correct me if I'm wrong, the real sticking point was that in the course of teaching about the history of white supremacy, the professor showed a slide that included MAGA in the slide.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the
graphic,
right.
Make
mm-hmm.
America Great Again graphic used to.
That included, among other things. And so that's the thing that when the senator's office was contacted, that they then contacted the administration. And, you know, many of our great universities across the country are state universities. They're run by states. Their boards are appointed politically by state legislatures and by governors. And the extent to which these state institutions that have, you know, been at the center of this great American university experiment are, you know, subject to this kind of political pressure on the kind of the most specific thing about what was on one slide in one classroom on one day is a real cautionary tale.
I think it goes back to, too, though, you know, universities really are supposed to be places where you get all kinds of different information and all kinds of different viewpoints, and you bring in all kinds of different speakers. And it doesn't mean that you have to agree with everything, but that you're enlightened to it all so that you can understand where other sides are coming from and you can understand a longer dialogue of American history and global history. So I think that's the other thing that's being cracked down on here, right, is to, and that's what I mean by whitewash, is to strip the ability to be able to engage and learn how to engage positively in this idea exchange.
It does seem incredible to me, but I know it's common, but one student contacts a senator's office. The senator is an ally of the president. The senator contacts the university. And the next thing, that professor is suspended and has been taken out from teaching the class called Diversity, Human Rights, and Social Justice. The professor, by the way, is Jessica Adams. And she, for her part, says the intent of the graphic has been misinterpreted. And it is a graphic widely used as an illustration that shows a pyramid with examples of statements and behavior that might be considered overt or covert white supremacy.
Can I, since I have a book out on voting rights today, I just want to add something here, which is, and I have a piece coming out in Talking Points Memo later this week about this, in which we make the argument, Yael Bromberg and I make the argument, that we are now in what we call a second redemption. All right. So you had Civil War followed by Reconstruction, and then you have this 1877 compromise, and Jim Crow gets launched, and that's known as the redemption. Black office holders are removed by the end of the century. You get a situation where, you know, of segregation, deprivation of the franchise, and all of these things. Then in the 1950s and 60s, you have what's called the Second Reconstruction. It begins with Brown versus the Board of Education, and runs through the Voting Rights Act, which is sort of the crown jewel of the Second Reconstruction. And now what we see in voting, and Jennifer mentioned this before earlier, you know, a real, first of all, the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, which I think will only get worse coming up. But all of these different types of actions, you know, stopping absentee balloting, limiting poll hours, gerrymandering and so forth, which is really reshaping the political environment and removing rights. And what's moreover, to get to the topic of universities, you know, it's not just this one case in Indiana, Texas A&M. If you're going to talk about race, you need to submit your syllabus to the chancellor. So things that I might teach, for example, in Alabama in the 1950s, you had coal counties with zero black registered voters. All right. Tuskegee University, a case study in the book, which was gerrymandered. The city of Tuskegee was gerrymandered so that 410 of the 420 registered black voters were removed from the city. In a Supreme Court case, Gamillion versus Lightfoot, that was brought by a professor at Tuskegee University, you know, we are heading back to this. I would add that a part of the Second Reconstruction was things like the removal of the poll tax, 24th Amendment, and what we write about in our book, the 26th Amendment, which is the lowering of the voting age from 21 to 18. And for all these groups, black and brown populations, poor and young, the decisions that are being made right now are diminishing their voting power and diminishing their democratic rights. And I think we should call it what it is, which is a redemption. Not in the in a historical sense.
Right. Well, and this is also, you know, the in the last few years, too, the look at economics, especially in black and brown communities. And that other name for this period is like the Third Reconstruction, right? How do we rebuild and reconstruct this nation in a way where it's taking into account that we're in the information age, that economics were never really fully addressed by the civil rights movement in the 1950s, right? And also our systemic racism in the criminal justice system itself was never fully addressed either, right? And our remedies since then have not really been successful from the local level all the way up to the Supreme Court level. And so now we're seeing the Supreme Court in the shape that it is, weighing in, which they should, right? Deciding cases that it does appear are dismantling the victories of the civil rights movement, but they're doing in a way that's kind of a colorblind rhetoric, which is a mask for returning to the way things used to be, which is, again, a frightening way to think about it, because the way things used to be for some of us who are black and brown weren't that great.
Yeah.
Right?
I just want to say that this whole idea of creating new narratives, mm-hmm. to create a new moral mask, so to speak, for these highly illiberal things. I'm working on a project at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs, and we're looking into that very specifically. We're mostly focused on U.S. foreign policy issues and other kind of global issues around this, but it's the same thing that you're talking, mm-hmm. about now around voting rights. This is really a major difference between the first Trump administration and the current Trump administration, and there is clearly a concerted effort to do this, and it appears to be, unfortunately, wildly successful in some ways, this moral masking.
Mm-hmm. 2 points I would like to make. One is that as we were talking about Texas A&M, we did this story on Friday, and I just wanted to remind myself of the language. So I quickly Googled Texas A&M, and the first 3 pages were all about the football team.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
well,
there's
yes.
that. They had a good game. Okay, fine. Now, but my question, Jonathan, is how, what is the sustainability of something like this, where you have this approval system that is put into place that has to, that anytime you go to want to teach, and I guess we were having this discussion about Bill Breslin from Skidmore College and their political science department. I was saying, so you have a story that is breaking today about the Supreme Court, and you want to talk about that case in the Supreme Court, and then like how does that work? What is the sustainability of that?
Right. So here's what I'd say. So I've spent a lot of my time abroad, working with and for universities abroad. You know, Bard was the first university period to be kicked out of Russia, to be named an enemy of Russia's constitutional order.
Your fault?
It was my fault, and I was denounced.
Good for you.
Who would have thought Russian media would denounce the promotion of a liberal arts education? It was crazy. But I also worked for the Central European University in Budapest, which was kicked out of the country by Orban, the father of illiberal democracy, what he calls illiberal democracy, where they kicked out an American university, which have, by the way, been replaced by Chinese universities. It's crazy. What I would say is that the biggest threat to academic freedom is self-censorship. And new authoritarians try to create uncertainty so that when I'm about to say that, to say, look what's happened, I will hesitate, right? And all you need is a few examples and people back off. You have a huge number of faculty, I know, because I'm one of the people who hires them, who, coming from some of the universities in the States, Florida, New College Florida was we were trying to support New College Florida when it was being eviscerated by Ron DeSantis, that professors want to leave there because they feel that they cannot speak their truths. And professors will not address these topics because they fear of the consequences. So I agree from a sort of bureaucratic perspective, it is very difficult to remove these things. But they're saying, submit your syllabus early, which almost no professors do because we're all working on them to the last minute. And then if you deviate from this, you are subject to complaint, especially by students ratting you out, which seems like something from the Soviet era, quite frankly. And it's really frightening. So I think self-censorship is the biggest threat, and that is the biggest problem that we will face.
And I also think that it's the ripple effects of this will not just be what somebody presents in the classroom, whether it's via their syllabus or it's an image like what we saw in Indiana. But over time, the self-censorship can also be hiring decisions. Who's going to be hired and who's not going to be hired? Tenure and promotion.
Mm-hmm.
These are at the heart of what makes any academic institution work. And when you start to have administrations, you know, subject to intense political pressure, and they're making those kinds of ultimate decisions about not only what is taught in the classroom, but who's teaching it, and who will be promoted, and who will be rewarded, and who will not. That's sadly the logical conclusion of this kind of behavior. And so I say, though, so to what end? Really, to what end? To destroy something that has been at the heart of, you know, both American society and American economic engine, to dismantle this. Why? You know, what is being sought here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I'm a person who practices or believes in the practice of listening doesn't mean you automatically agree. Right? Sometimes we find ourselves at a place where if you listen to somebody else, you know, people think, well, that means that I agreed because I listened. And I think listening is very important because it allows you to consider, right? And to think about different opinions, different angles of different things. And ultimately, it also helps you to be able to communicate better about all of these issues. And we are seeing across the country, and is predominantly minority professors, but also, we'll say white, just for lack of a better term right now, professors who are also discussing these topics, and they're facing the same kind of backlash, right? So what this does then is it threatens to force them to compete for the scarce positions or jobs that may be left. But it's also creating a huge or potential unemployment kind of space for these specialized people or for these professors. And so you're going to see it a racial outcome to also who's losing the jobs, the economic decline of their households. And they're already fragile to begin with. Just a few years ago in the diversity issues in higher education, they talked about, you know, the losing of homes and homelessness. And they were saying, and they, through the research, that the ones who are most the most instability is among Black and brown professors because they're already paid less. And there's job scarcity, even in other subjects that are not sort of this history or racial or cultural, you know, kind of fields. And so that's going to be exacerbated by this, too. Fewer jobs, you are getting laid off, more competition if those jobs do exist, and less places to be able to find them if states are eliminating departments or, right, banning the fields.
So that's the big thing, which is, you know, again, as a senior university administrator with many titles, you know, we're looking at the closure of humanities departments, the closure of doctoral programs in the humanities and social sciences. And part, again, of the authoritarian playbook is to attack these bastions of areas where there is critical thinking, thought, and discussion, and so forth. And there's also sort of this neoliberal, what is, you know, employability outcomes, right, which we could have a long debate about. But the real threat beyond this is that these departments just disappear, and they are disappearing. They're being eliminated. You know, Indiana University, the same university, consolidated numerous majors this year, and there will be losses in these areas, which are significant, and exacerbated again by a policy which limits international students from coming here, for example, which is a blow to one of America's most successful industries. So I think it is very, very broad. There's a whole other topic to be discussed about historically by colleges and universities, but maybe that will be another whole roundtable on that.
Sounds good.
Can we, before we go though,
yes,
can we please talk about Ukraine? I really think we need a little time with Ukraine.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, go ahead.
I just wanted to say one thing on the international students thing too. So, I mean, just out now is a report from the Institute of International Education, and it's noting that overall, the number of international students who are studying in the U.S. is down just 1%. But newly arrived international students, ones who would be coming this year at the undergraduate or graduate levels, down 17%. And so if you start to play this forward over multiple years of this administration, that is going to have a tremendously deleterious effect on institutions of higher education in so many different ways, and on the American economy, and on what has been particularly since the the Cold War and onward, our ability to just kind of magnetize and draw in the best talent around the world. Mm-hmm. This is a massive self-inflicted wound, and I don't know how it's going to be reversed.
As for Ukraine, we do want to spend a moment or two on this before we break and welcome Jonathan mm-hmm. to discuss the new book, Youth Voting Rights. So we'll get back to that subject in a second. This from the New York Times: Zelensky's image is stained as corruption inquiry shakes his inner circle. The revelations are remarkable. Reversal for the Ukrainian president, who once presented himself as a leader who would clean up the country's politics. They tell a story in this article as he considered a run for president of Ukraine. The former comedian joked about the country's rampant high-level corruption. Is it possible to become president and not steal? Mr. Zelensky quipped. It's a rhetorical question, and no one has tried so far. Mr. Zelensky's promises to fight corruption propelled him to the presidency in 2019 and underpinned his politics before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. But now, a sweeping corruption investigation that has reached his inner circle is threatening his support both at home and abroad and tarnishing his image as a lionized wartime leader. What happened?
I want to just pair that crisis, that political crisis that Zelensky is having, along with the military crisis that's going on. And, I was telling Jonathan, who has spent a lot of time in Ukraine as well, that I'm hearing from friends of mine there, and they're saying that the situation feels very, very fragile, maybe the most from the very beginning of this conflict. And it appears that the Russians have improved their tactics, which have been not effective militarily, and that, tacitly, the Russians have been given, it seems to be, a green light from the Americans. I mean, you have Trump saying, oh, we're going to give the Ukrainians tomahawks, and then talking to Putin and say, well, we're not going to give them tomahawks. It's going to be a ceasefire. Well, no, there's not going to be a ceasefire. And Putin is very clearly seeking to make gains on the battlefield, because these will result in gains around the diplomatic table for negotiations at some point. And that's simply how it works. And he knows that equation very, very well. So while you have the Ukrainian president in the midst of a political crisis, you have this military conflict really heating up in a way that I think is not being reported as well as it ought to be. And there's a real sense that things could cascade very, very quickly and very badly. And let's just remember the nature of this conflict against Ukrainians. You have, targeting of civilian populations over and over and over again, war crimes being committed. You have rape used as a weapon of war. You have many thousands of Ukrainian children spirited away and into Russia, and on and on. The idea that the Ukrainians are going to just kind of give up, that's not going to happen. But the system could actually, it could collapse in a way that we anticipated at the beginning of this conflict, and now it might actually happen.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll hear from the other panelists on this issue, and then we'll get into youth voting rights. But first, a news break. We welcome you and your letters, as always. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we were talking about Ukraine. Just heard from Jim Ketterer on this. Would like to hear.
So I was just saying to Jim during the break that I haven't seen a lot of information about Ukraine and all these things in the news. It's not getting all the attention that I wish it would, so that I could follow what's happening. And thinking back on one of the peace deals that was thrown out there, or the ceasefire, it was more a ceasefire deal, was the one where America would, and I can't get all my words right about this, but America would have control over certain cities or natural resources coming out of them. And so I'm wondering if Ukraine falls because of what's happening and Russia takes over, what does that mean for the products that are being output from Ukraine? Does Russia just control them? How does that shake up the world order economically if that happens?
Wow, that's a big one. I mean,
I know.
The only thing I would say here is that the dilemma right now is huge because the United States is no longer supporting Ukraine effectively.
Right.
I would say the most sort of shameful moment of my adult life was watching J.D. Vance denounce Zelensky at the White House for the Russian invasion being mm-hmm. Ukraine's fault, mm-hmm. which is, black and white have just mm-hmm. disappeared or have flip-flopped in that circumstance. So they're on their own, and this corruption scandal comes at a horrible time mm-hmm. Because they're waiting for loans from the European Union, which would take, money confiscated from Russian assets. So they need to clean house internally. There is certainly corruption there. In this summer, Zelensky also made a big mistake trying to disband a corruption commission. They've dismissed people in the government who were responsible for that. But this is an existential, as Jim was saying, mm-hmm. an existential issue for Ukraine and Ukrainians.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, in spite of what Jim said, Russia's taken like 1.5% more land than they had before, mm-hmm. which is not a lot given how big, the Russian army is and how weak Ukraine was. Ukraine has become a world leader in drones,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I don't think Ukraine's going to fall mm-hmm. easily. I do think Putin's trying to consolidate what he has so he could take the entire mm-hmm. Donbas region, which
right.
is the east of Ukraine, and keep Crimea. Which is the real prize, which was taken in 2014. So we'll see. But this is an incredibly inopportune time for this to happen in Ukraine. They are also damaging Russia through drone attacks on refinery facilities and others across the country, which is escalating things.
Right.
At the same time, Russia is increasingly attacking trains, the electrical system, and so forth, and with some more efficacy. So we'll see where this ends. I think one thing that is for sure, though, is America's reputation as an ally.
Mm-hmm.
And not just of Ukraine, but when Russia was sending drones into Poland, into Baltic countries, which are now part of NATO, we have averted our eyes. And our reputation as a world leader, as something represented freedom, is totally compromised by turning our backs on Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and undermining the efficacy of the probably the most effective military alliance in history ever, NATO.
Mm-hmm.
If we're not going to back it up and have it mean something— it's just going to wither away.
Where does it leave all our allies as well as they deal with this as well?
Yeah, I mean, I can remember years ago, I was in Ukraine, actually, and I ended up at a dinner with some diplomats from some of the Baltic countries, and the U.S. had just failed to respond properly in their eyes to the Russian seizure of Crimea. And in violation of a document that we had signed. And so they were saying over dinner, to what extent do you really think that the United States will support Article 5 that requires you to defend us? Would you go to war to defend our little countries? And that was in 2014. So if we play it forward now, I think there's almost no confidence that the U.S. would back up those paper guarantees.
All right. We are going to call it there for the panel portion of the program. My thanks to Jennifer Burns and Jim Ketterer for being with us. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Good to see you both, as always. When we come back, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to hold Jonathan Becker with us and talk about the brand new book, Youth Voting Rights, Civil Rights, the 26th Amendment, and the Fight for American Democracy on College Campuses. The book comes out tomorrow. We will talk about it today. All of that and much more right after this break.